I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. In the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement, we'll examine what some call the pornification of our culture. More than 93% of boys and 63% of girls will be exposed to internet pornography before the age of 18. How does this rampant hypersexualization impact the way we view and treat women? And what are the special challenges faced by women of color? Dr. Gail Dines is a feminist scholar and the founder and president of Culture Reframed, which addresses pornography as a public health crisis. Shanita Hubbard is an educator and writer who authored a provocative piece about black women and the hashtag MeToo movement for the New York Times. Midday Culture Connections starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. Happy New Year. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for tuning in to Midday on this very chilly day. Current temperature in Baltimore, 20 degrees. It's 19 in Frederick. It's a whole lot colder given the wind chill. So stay bundled up. And if there are particularly seniors in your compass, in your neighborhood or near where you are now, make sure you check in on them and that they're doing okay. A warning, by the way, to listeners who may be tuning in with young children today. We're going to be talking about very mature topics on this edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. The sexual assault allegations against powerful men in Hollywood and pretty much every other industry has shined a light on the pervasiveness of sexual predatory behavior. Today, we'll examine the ways hypersexualized images of women on television, on the internet, and in print distort the ways that our culture views and treats women. Scholars have called it pornification. Pornography dominates the internet. More people view internet porn every month than click on Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. So how does pornography affect mainstream popular culture? And how do the images of women that we encounter every day affect the ways women view themselves and the ways men view and interact with women? Is the modern multi-billion dollar pornography industry inherently violent and sexist against women? And if so, what does it mean that 93% of boys and 63% of girls will be exposed to internet porn before the age of 18? Sherry Parks joins us for Midday Culture Connections on the first Tuesday of every month. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Happy New Year, Sherry.
Happy New Year.
It's good to have you here. Thanks so much. And Dr. Gail Dines is with us as well. She's a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston. She's the founder and president of Culture Reframed, a nonprofit organization that addresses pornography as a public health crisis. She's the author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. She joins us on the line from WGBH in Boston. Dr. Dines, Happy New Year and welcome to the show.
Happy New Year to you both. Thank you very much.
Hi.
So, Sherry, when it comes to this pervasiveness of pornography and the number of people who are viewing pornography, 70% of men and 30% of women watch porn regularly. What does that mean for so-called mainstream culture?
And that's actually a conservative estimate. Some go as high as 85% are regularly using it. Last month when we talked about the princess narrative, and at the very end I said there was a collision between the narratives that many girls have been brought up with and the narratives
because we were talking about Meghan Markle her upcoming nuptials.
And the narratives that now many men and boys are using, and that is pornography. And we should say that the definition that I use and that Gail uses, that porn inherently has violence, are unequal power. So we're differentiating it from erotica, which may be consensual and equal. So inherently it has that power. And what's happened, and Gail will go deeply into this, is that there has been a mainstreaming from a generation ago when there was a theater on a corner in the block here in Baltimore, to VHS and cable, to the internet, it has become much more of a private entity and much more mainstream. And because we are saying that porn inherently has power or inequity, you begin to see how it begins to create a context for the sexual harassment and rape that we've been talking about over the last couple of months. That hasn't been covered so much recently by the media. We've been really tied into, he did this, he did this, he did this. And this is the larger picture, that they are reenacting to some degree what is now mainstream media.
Does that sound right to you, Gail Dines? I mean, when we hear about the sort of brutish and hideous behavior of the Harvey Weinsteins in the world, or even the Charlie Roses, you know, inviting women to their hotel rooms and having their bathrobes open, and or Louis C.K., performing self-sex acts in front of women that he's invited to his dressing room or his hotel room. Are they getting those ideas from pornography?
Well, it's impossible to take one individual and say, you know, they got it from porn. What we can say is that we know that porn and exposure to porn and use of porn has now become mainstream and is shifting an entire sexual template of boys all over the world. And increasingly, when you look at what these men did, remember, these men are older. These were men who grew up in the Playboy era more really than in the present day era, which means things are going to be much worse as those boys who are exposed to porn and mainstream violent porn, because that's what all most porn that's mainstream today is violent. When the ones who are exposed to those who are going to grow up and be the age of Harvey Weinstein in 20, 30 years are going to do much worse violence against women, given that the pornography they're exposed to. So whether these guys saw porn, and certainly given the sex acts that they and the sexual harassment, it sounds straight out of porn, yes. And I think it's very important to talk about pornography in the cultural context, because if we don't put this sexual harassment and violence that men do to women in a cultural context, then what we do is we end up with a kind of biological determinism, which says that men are just born predators, born Johns, born pimps, born rapists. And I don't think as feminists, any of us would agree with that. I think we're feminists because we believe that the culture sets the bar way too low for men, and that we live in a culture which is really a porn culture that gives men sort of permission-giving values that they can do this to women. If we don't take the cultural context, we end up down that rabbit hole of there's nothing we can do, boys will be boys, there's no point in doing anything. And I see that as a politics of despair rather than a politics of hope, which feminism has always embraced.
Yeah, Sherry Parks, boys will be boys is still a refrain we hear all of the time.
Well, definitely so. But I mean, I think what's really important that Gail pulled out is that this is the cultural context in which they act. And in many of the acts that have been reported, power was a really important element, that the perpetrator had the power and the victim, in most cases women, not always, did not. And that is an essential narrative trope of pornography. And that's really important, that idea. And the idea that the woman in this case is almost just a prop, not a human with needs or desires or agency of her own, but just a prop.
And Gail Dines, talk about the importance or the distinguishing characteristics of accessibility to pornography because of the internet, as opposed to what you referred to in your TED talk and in some of the writing you've done about this, as the sort of, you know, the innocence of Playboy magazine or Penthouse magazine, you know, of the 60s and 70s in their heyday. I mean, what makes the internet different about the other delivery systems for pornography traditionally?
Well, first of all, I would never say that Playboy or Penthouse was innocent. They were sexist and misogynist, but they were different to what we have today. So just think about, you know, two generations ago, you were 14, male, your hormones are raging, you find your father's Playboy, your older brother's Playboy. You had kind of limited access to images of women with no clothes on, with a coy smile bending over. That was kind of your introduction. And there was really, it was limited because there was only so much of the stash you could steal before they realized it was gone. Today, thanks to the internet, which really became domesticated around 2000, pornography is now affordable, accessible, and anonymous, the three A's that drive demand. And what happens when you study the business side of pornography and the internet, which is a lot of my research, is that what was amazing is, first of all, the internet did not so much drive pornography as pornography drove the internet. Much of the money coming to develop the internet actually came out of the porn industry. So that's a very important thing to remember when we talk about the new technologies that we're just waiting for in a few years. Secondly, between 2000 and 2003, when you saw a huge amount of porn uploaded onto the internet and porn sites springing up everywhere, what was astounding to anyone who studied it is how hardcore it got so quickly. And that was a real major shift, was that suddenly softcore porn migrated into pop culture, and what was left by the porn industry being produced was actually hardcore. And then the next major date is around 2009, when a company that nobody's ever heard of, at the time it was called Manwin, started by a man called Fabian Thiemann, who was a German businessman, he invented the free porn sites, Pornhub, YouPorn, etc. And now what happened is that every kid had access to pornography because porn was free. And let's really think, who goes to free porn sites? Those who don't have a credit card. So now we know that the top 10 visited porn sites in the world are free porn sites. They're owned by the same company. It's no longer called Manwin because Fabian Thiemann was put under house arrest for tax evasion. So they kicked him out and they changed the name to MindGeek. And I think what a lot of people don't really realize is, you know, although there's just millions of images of porn up there, the most traveled porn sites are owned by one company, which is housed in Luxembourg with most of its offices in Canada. So, and it's hardcore porn. And I think this is very hard for people to realize, that for the average 11, 12-year-old boy, which is the first age in which most boys view porn, when you put porn or whatever, butt or whatever into Google, you are catapulted into a world of sexual violence. That in our father's generation, if you wanted to look at that level of sexual violence, you would have to go to a porn shop and you would have to know somebody who had access to a particular type of violent porn. That today is mainstream, which is why at Culture Reframed, which is the organization which I founded, we have developed and will be going live next in a few weeks with a parents program, because the problem here is parents do not know what is going on. I lecture across the world, and wherever I go, parents are stunned when they find out what their boys are actually accessing. And increasingly, as Sherry mentioned, girls are looking at porn as well. So it's really shifting what sex means in our culture. The pornographers have de facto become the major form of sex education all over the world. Anywhere that any kid has a mobile device, the pornographers are now their major form of sex ed. And that is going to have, we know from empirical research, incredible repercussions on what's going to happen to the boys and, of course, the girls that they're then going to play out the porn sex on.
Sherry Parks.
I want to circle back to something that you said about the role of porn in tech innovation. This is not something that Gail had to extrapolate. The conventions between the two industries are often held simultaneously, or have been historically held simultaneously, and people are moving back and forth. So that porn has...
I'm sorry, back and forth between which industries?
In Las Vegas, you would have a porn conference on one block and a tech conference
oh,
on
a tech.
Another
okay. So not tech directly related to porn, but as Gail says, the innovations that have come
right
to the internet are developed by the porn industry.
Right, but what happens is that people are moving back and forth between those two conferences. Mm-hmm. They're held at the same time for a reason. And so since porn has such an economic incentive to make things more realistic, it was really pushing, has been really pushing the tech industry instead of the other way around. And then the other thing, and I'm going to just say this and let Gail talk about it, we probably need to explain desensitization, why you move from soft porn to hard porn as a consumer so quickly.
Desensitization. Uh-huh. Gail, what do you think?
Okay, so Sherry's exactly right. That's a key concept here. So what you find is that very quickly, because the porn is so hardcore, these boys get into porn, they get into hardcore porn immediately. They have been kind of groomed or socialized in our culture via just pop culture images of hypersexualization. Also remember video games, which are extremely violent, like Grand Theft Auto, where you actually get points for killing prostituted women. So those are the things they use as kids. And then around 11 and 12, when they're through their peer group or whatever, they get into pornography. And almost immediately, the only porn that they can get is hardcore. And then you get desensitized to the hardcore. So what you find is they start looking for harder and harder core porn. And when I've spoken to therapists, what we're finding increasingly is that a lot of men who become porn addicts are seeking out children. And these are men who are not pedophiles, right? These are men who in other circumstances would never show any interest in children. And I interviewed 8 of these men in prison. None of them were pedophiles. They hadn't touched a child till their 40s. So that's not the profile of a pedophile. They were all in for downloading child porn and then raping a child. And when I said to them, you know, are you pedophiles? They were actually insulted and said, no, of course we're not. So I said, then why did you rape a child? And they said, well, we got bored with the regular porn and we wanted something different. So there's also, you know, this is a really serious issue now that not only are increasingly boys and men becoming more habituated and addicted to hardcore porn, it's also leading to a whole class of boys and men who are now turning to children and sexually harassing and raping children who would not be doing that. And it's very hard to get your mind around that because we've often thought of, you know, men who rape children are a different category. And that certainly was true, I would say, 20 to 30 years ago. What the research is showing today is that they're increasingly merging with men who are not pedophiles.
Dr. Gail Dines is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College in Boston. She's the author of Pornland, How Porn Was Hijacked. Has hijacked our society. Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. We'll have more on the pornification of American culture when we return. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take a break, last month, on December 20th, Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby was my guest for the hour here on Midday. And during her appearance on our program, we received a number of tweets and emails about the case of Keith Davis, Jr. In October of last year, Mr. Davis was convicted of second-degree murder in the death of a man named Kevin Jones. Last month, a judge granted Mr. Davis a new trial, which is scheduled for April. I asked State's Attorney Mosby about the case, and this is what she had to say.
This is what happened in the case that is already closed and he's been convicted in. He was accused of attempting to rob a taxi driver, a hack. That taxi driver alerted the police. And when he did that, Keith Davis jumped out of the car. The police officer followed him into a mechanic shop. And a civilian witness also witnessed this. Keith Davis had a gun in his hand. He ran behind a refrigerator, pointed the gun at the police officer. And it's not just the police officer's version of events. It's a civilian witness who also has this version of events. This was tried in front of a jury of his peers. He was found in the, once he pointed the gun, the officers shot back at him. They found him guilty. And let me say that the cab driver was unable to say whether or not that was Keith Davis. He was frantic. He said, hey, all I know is it was a guy with a gun. So, but we had the civilian witness that saw him come out, the police officer that saw him get out the car and followed him. In any event, he was convicted of being a felon in possession of a handgun. That handgun was tied to a murder 5 hours before. And so I can't get into the specifics, but there's more evidence that would suggest not just the gun that's tied to that murder that he's currently pending, but there's other evidence that suggests that he is the murderer. So my focus has always been Kevin Jones. This is not about Keith Davis. This is about Kevin Jones and how he lost his life unreasonably that day.
So a number of listeners took issue with the state's attorney's comments about this case. We invited Mr. Davis's attorney, Latoya Francis Williams, to send a statement in response to the state's attorney. Her statement is as follows. Regarding my client, Keith Davis Jr., Marilyn Mosby did not try any of the cases brought by her office against Mr. Davis, nor was she present for any day of any trial or procedural hearings. She is simply misinformed as to the facts. Mr. Davis was not convicted of robbing or attempting to rob anyone. He was acquitted of those charges by a jury. He did not pull a gun on anyone. He was acquitted of these charges by a jury. And contrary to the state's attorney's statements on your show, no civilian witness ever testified or even reported such allegations. Ms. Mosby is clearly disseminating misinformation about this case to improperly influence our jury pool come April. Such reckless disregard for the truth is counterproductive to the pursuit of justice, a goal her office touts. In fact, after three trials on the same facts, it would be in the interest of justice for the state to now review the real remaining admissible evidence and do belated justice to Mr. Davis by null prossing same. That means to dismiss the case, in other words. Anything less reveals that the state's true motivation to drag Mr. Davis through a fourth trial is solely political. Again, that's a statement from LaToya Frances Williams. She is the attorney for Keith Davis Jr. We have posted Ms. Williams' statement on our website, where you can also hear my complete interview with State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby at wypr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. New Year again. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to Midday. By the way, coming up on our program on tomorrow, Wednesday, a conversation about the issues before the Baltimore City Council as the new year begins. First-term council members Christopher Burnett and Robert Stokes Sr. will join me. I hope you can join us, too, for Midday. That's tomorrow at noon. If you're just joining us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. Dr. Parks is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Also with us is Dr. Gail Dines of Wheelock College up in Boston. She's the author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Our phone number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So Dr. Dines, I wonder if we could pick up on a point you made before the break, and that is this desensitization and men moving to ever more violent and pernicious forms of pornography, from soft, so-called soft core porn to I don't know what you would call the next stage, but then to get to the point where they are raping children. Why is that a common? Have the therapists and the data or researchers done any data about why that progression seems to be so common? What is it that that makes people move from, you know, watching sex acts with adults to sex acts with children so seemingly naturally?
Well, I mean, increasingly now we're seeing more research come out of the neuroscience journals. And what you're finding is that actually, like all kind of drugs in a way, there's a kind of dopamine release. And what happens is, you know, just like with alcohol, you need more and more to get drunk. You need more and more other substances in order to get a high. This is happening too with pornography. In fact, they found that pornography even can burn out your dopamine receptors from overuse of porn. So what you're seeing here is the boredom, and this is what, when I've interviewed men, they get bored, which basically translates into they're not producing enough dopamine to give them a high and they need to look for something different. And when you interview men who have been long-term users of porn, they talk about, you know, seeking out more bizarre, more violent, more degrading porn. They talk about the fact that they can no longer have sex. That's the one of the big issues around using a lot of porn, is these men are not sex addicts. There's an excellent activist called Gabe Deem, and he was a porn addict from a young age, and he's now runs an organization called Reboot Nation, which is helping men get and boys get off porn. And he said, I was never addicted to sex, I was always addicted to pixels. And so what happens is that you need to keep increasing the imagery, because your interest in actual sex with another human being of your own age or whatever decreases. And I think that's one reason they're going to children. There's many, many reasons why desensitization happens, but ultimately it's the same with any other substance that has a massive impact on the dopamine receptors. And I think through the neuroscience research, we're beginning to realize a lot more. For example, they did scans of porn addicts, methamphetamine addicts, cocaine and heroin addicts. And what they found is that porn released more dopamine than cocaine, than heroin, and is on the same level as methamphetamine. So there's actual, and the level of research and empiricism that you need to get published in these journals is much higher often than social science journals. So you can see the research is very robust now that's coming out around addiction, which I was very skeptical about. I might add, as a sociologist, I was thinking, you know, addiction is just a way out. It's a way for these men not to take responsibility for what they're doing. But actually, I have to take the research seriously because there's just, it's so interesting and compelling today.
And Sherry Parks, then how do these images, I mean, clearly, if there's so many people viewing these images, those aren't the images that we're seeing in mainstream media, are they? I mean, are the images in mainstream media getting progressively more violent and sexist and repugnant towards women?
Well, yes. I mean, certainly, and we've seen it in women's romance fiction and movies, but even more so, you've seen it in ads and music. There's a whole, I mean, the love song, the old-fashioned crooner love song is almost extinct. And now you will hear often a male singer singing to the presumably female listener about hurting, about power in ways. Stripper poles are now, in gyms. So that all of there's been a seepage of what used to be something that would be perceived as pornographic into mainstream media, so that it becomes, and one of the things that the media are really, really good at is normalizing something. If you see it, and some often that's a good thing, like, interracial marriages or whatever, you see it over and over in the media, it seems, quote, normal. And the same thing has happened with pornographic images, so that we no longer wince when we hear a, and it's a different type of desensitization, a milder form, but it's still very much there. We no longer wince when we hear about a love song where the woman is hurt in it. On purpose.
But there's nothing new about that. I mean, I'm thinking of two tunes. One of them is from the Great American Songbook, Baby, It's Cold Outside. We hear this a lot at this time of year, where the woman says, I really should go. Mm-hmm. And the guy says, Baby, it's cold outside, and gets more and more aggressive about keeping her in his apartment, right? I think when I was a little kid, when I was 10 years old, one of the hit records that somebody made a whole lot of money was, Hey There, Little Red Riding Hood, you sure are looking good, you're everything a big bad wolfy could want. Isn't that a child abuse song?
And yes, and nobody is saying that this is an absolutely new phenomenon. What we are saying is that it is much more overt and received by in ads, and there's no counterpart. The old love story is largely dead, except in literature. You'll still see it in literature.
I want to add to the conversation now Shanita Hubbard. She's joining us on the line from Bushkill, Pennsylvania. She's an adjunct professor of criminal justice at Northampton Community College in Pennsylvania. Last month, she wrote a very compelling essay in the New York Times called Russell Simmons, R. Kelly, and Why Black Women Can't Say #MeToo. Ms. Hubbard, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
So if you wrote about the particular challenges that women of color face when it comes to sexual harassment, sexual misconduct. Give us, for the listeners who haven't had a chance to read your piece, and we're going to, of course, post a link to it on our website, give us the thumbnail sketch of your point in that essay.
Well, the thumbnail sketch is that it's not that black women can't say Me Too. I think the title that the editor chose kind of is maybe could mislead people that didn't read the article. So I just wanted to be clear. It's not that it's kind of ironic because Me Too was founded and created by a black woman, Tarana Burke. So it's not that we can say it. Actually, in essence, we actually created it. The essay speaks to how complicated it can be when a black woman and the offender itself is a black man. So I broke down the different dynamics and the reasons why it's sort of complicated. Sometimes there's so many different factors involved where we Black women sometimes don't prioritize our own pain because there is kind of like greater needs in the community. So it's almost like a not right now when it comes to Black men. And if the offender is a Black man, which is why I suspect that the Me Too movement is not as loud as in the hip hop industry as it is in Hollywood, because in that case, there's a great chance that the victim and the offender are probably both going to be Black, and there's so many different variables when it comes forward to talk about publicly about sexual harassment in those cases.
And the data that you referred to in the piece indicates, for example, that only 1 in 15 African American women report being raped. I mean, there seems to be a much greater degree of silence about the misconduct and the assaults that Black women are undergoing than there is in other communities. Why is there a particular reason for that? I mean, do you identify any particular thing about that?
Yes, I suspect it's because when for us, for Black women, it's a lot of times our pain isn't kind of prioritized, right? And one of the things I wrote in a piece is that we've seen what unchecked power of white men has done to our communities, right? We've seen what this looks like. And then another level of that is a lot of times Black women aren't believed or aren't heard. And just given with the same example of Me Too, we've seen a lot of really affluent women come forward. And Lupita is actually one of those women that came forward. She's a Black woman. She's affluent. She's successful. She's beautiful. And she was probably, to my understanding, the only woman in question where Harvey Weinstein, when she accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment, she's the only woman that he said, I don't really recall the events happening like that. He questioned her story. No other woman kind of experienced that. And this treatment is not exclusive to Hollywood. This is what happens when, in general, to society, when Black women kind of speak up. I'm thinking about that. I think it's Daniel Holtwood's case when there was a police officer whose victims were all Black women, all predominantly Black women, and this went on for a really long time. And one of the things that came up was that they're targeted because society and people are less likely to believe them. So because of these things, we don't necessarily report as frequently.
We have a number of folks who want to get in on our conversation. Let's go to the phones now. Sharon in Owings Mills, welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Good afternoon. I just wanted to note the fact that this really is, I agree, it's not something new. It's been taking over our culture for quite a while. When I was first teaching back in the 90s, I taught a course on advertising, and I asked my students about what was the most popular component of advertising on TV, and they came back and they said, scantily clad people, mostly women. So you're bombarded with these kinds of visuals every single time you see an advertisement for clothing, for going to on vacation, for buying soap in the store. You're seeing somebody who's wearing very little, if anything at all, on the television. And this is not censored in any way, shape, or form, especially nowadays. The other thing is that I was living in Texas when I first got married a few years back, and I decided I didn't want to raise my kids in that state because there were billboards of women who either had nothing more than a bra and a pair of underwear, or maybe just a pair of underwear, and these were advertisements for topless bars. And they were all over the place.
Okay, well, thanks for the call, Sharon. I think we get your point. And Gail Dines, there's an interesting dichotomy in one way. I mean, a few years ago when Janet Jackson had her now infamous wardrobe malfunction, it seemed like there was this burst of prurience that came up. All of a sudden, oh my gosh, a woman's breasts were exposed on television during the Super Bowl, no more exposed than any beach in France. I mean, so there's that side of it, as well as this, as you say, this hypersexualization of images of women in in the media. I have another question for you, and that's about, you mentioned these porn sites are now free, and that's why they're accessible to young boys and young girls. If they're free, how does the porn industry make money on them? What's the financial model here?
Okay, so first of all, I just want to make the point, following Shanita, that Janet Jackson was actually a woman of color, an African-American, and her career was virtually ruined over what happened to her, while Justin Timberlake was absolutely ignored and went on to be more successful. So I think it's very important to say that, you know, all women's bodies have been cheapened in this culture, but African-American women's bodies are the cheapest bodies that is shown in this culture. So I think it's really important to add in the race factor around Janet Jackson. Number two, how do they make money? Very interesting. Their goal is to monetize the traffic so that you get a lot of kids going on, of course, but then you also get men, and they have videos, and often the videos are 5 to 7 minutes, which is too short for the guy to do what he wants to do. And as it's coming to an end, the video, there's pop-ups for paid sites. And of course, in a frenzy to finish off, the guy then goes into the paid sites. Also, when you go on Pornhub or YouPorn, the first page, the very expensive real estate, they sell off often to what we call cam girls. These are women who in real time advertise having sort of private sex shows with guys who go on these sites. So the goal is to monetize, to take what is free traffic and turn it into money via buying money through cam girls, via buying money through penile whatever drugs, because there's a lot of erectile dysfunction for men who use porn, also by getting them to go to the paid websites. And clearly it's working, because MindGeek, which, as I say, owns the top 10 free porn sites, is expanding and expanding and expanding all the time and making more and more money each year. So they are clearly monetizing their traffic.
Dr. Gail Dines is the author of Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality. Shanita Hubbard is an adjunct professor of criminal justice at Northampton Community College in Pennsylvania. Her essay last month in the New York Times is called Russell Simmons, R. Kelly, and Why Black Women Can't Say Hashtag Me Too. Dr. Sherry Parks is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. More on sexual assault, sexual misconduct, and what scholars call pornification in our culture. You're welcome to join us at 410-662-8780 after a break. Our email, midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Before we take that break, about a year ago, we began reading the names of the people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore. We do this once a week on Mondays here on Midday, and we do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hours of grief. 2 Mondays ago was Christmas Day, and yesterday was, of course, New Year's Day, and we broadcast archive editions of our programs on both of those occasions. So today I will share with you the names of the homicide victims in Baltimore City during the final 2 weeks of 2017, a year that saw 343 people in Baltimore City lose their lives to violence. That is a record number of homicides given the current population of our city and the deadliest year since 1993. William Wallace, age 38, died last September from injuries sustained in a shooting back in 1995. On December 22nd, police ruled his death a homicide. 12 men were also killed in Baltimore in the last 2 weeks of December. They are Donnell Haley, age 27, Devon Perkins, age 31, James Forrester, age 43, Jonathan Tobash, age 19, Velani Campbell, age 22, Leroy Moore, age 45, Rezon Owens Green, age 20, Wesley Langford, age 41, Quincy Hammonds, age 18, William Wallace, age 38, Daniel Mulhausen, age 25, and Markel Coleman. He was 24 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be back after a quick break. Back. I'm Tom Hall. Today, it's the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Park. She's an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland in College Park. Shanita Hubbard is with us as well. She's a writer and social justice advocate. She wrote a piece for the New York Times entitled Russell Simmons, R. Kelly, and Why Black Women Can't Say #MeToo. And Dr. Gail Dines, she's with us from Boston. She's a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So, Dr. Dines, before we let you go, let me ask you one final question, and that is your efforts to combat the pervasiveness of pornography and the deleterious effects it has on society as a whole and on young boys in particular by approaching it as a public health issue. Briefly state, tell us what that public health approach entails.
Okay, so public health is really about looking specifically at how you prevent, and then once, if you can't prevent, how do you then make the harm less? So when we sat down at Culture Reframed, and anyone can go on our website, Culture Reframed, R-E-F-R-A-M-E-D, Reframing a Picture, E-D, cultureReframed.org, what we decided to do is, following the public health protocols, is to do prevention. And what we know is the biggest, most important preventive factor is knowledge with parents. And when it comes to pornography, parents do not know what's out there. Many of them grew up in the Playboy era. They think of Playboy when we talk about pornography. They really don't know that their kids around 12 or 13 are accessing pornography. And very importantly, they don't know how to have a conversation about with their kids about sex education, pornography, or any of these issues. So what we've done, and is going live in about 2 weeks, is we've built a program, an online free program for parents of how to basically learn the skills and the tools to have conversations, brave and courageous conversations with your kids about pornography before they start using it or before they get into trouble with it. We have 12 modules, and the 12th module is actually scripted out conversations between you and your teen or tween about how to talk about pornography, how to talk about sexual consent, how to talk about peer pressure, how to talk about sexting, all the things that parents have to now do, because really this is an experimental generation of kids, because we've never brought up kids before with access to hardcore porn, and it's also an experimental generation for parents. We've never brought up parents before who've had to basically parent in the digital age, which is awash with pornified, hypersexualized images, and there is no group out there who have really helped to build resilience and resistance in kids by educating their parents.
All right, we will have a link to that website on our website, wipr.org/midday. Dr. Gail Dines, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you to your other guests. They were wonderful as well.
Thank you.
Dr. Gail Dines is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College. Sherry Parks and Shanita Hubbard still with us here on Midday. Sherry Parks, a lot of strands here that we've been talking about.
Yeah, and I want to circle back to something that Shanita said in terms of there are three stereotypes that are playing here, and African Americans are very sensitive to those. One is that of the black brute. The idea that the black man was the rapist who was going after white women is a trope in American culture. That still has a lot of currency. And so the community tends to be very protective of black men. This is related to the list of dead black men, mostly black men, that you read a few minutes ago. The community tends to be very, very protective, for good reason, of black men. And at the same time, you have this image that I've written about of the strong black woman who isn't even supposed to feel pain. So her role is to be protected. And often, if she does say something about rape, she either isn't believed or she's supposed to literally take it. At the same time, you have this image of the highly sexualized young black woman, which makes her less sympathetic as a rape victim. I've written about it in both editions of Fierce Angels, about being a rape survivor and the community working to protect him instead of me, and that he was the precious one. All of that is at play. Now, it's really interesting then to look at when black girls go missing, because this is linked also to sex trafficking. the vast majority of young girls who are being trafficked are girls of color. And it's linked both to the highly sexualized image and the idea that they don't get looked for in the same way. So their pain, even when they're missing, is not as valuable.
Yeah. And Shanita Hubbard, you write about the real conundrum, or that's much too soft a word, but the real problem that as Black women, you are often called to defend the same Black men that could be harassing you on the street. You talk about when you were a little kid, 12 years old, walking to and from school, being harassed by these guys, and then they themselves being harassed by the police, by each other, they have a whole panoply of problems that you have some sympathy for. But on the other hand, you talk about this proverbial intersection of race and sexism as a very complicated place. Shanita Hubbard, are you still with us? I guess we've lost Ms. Hubbard, but we will try to get her back. Let's go to the phones. We have Bridget in Baltimore. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, Tom. I guess I'll fill in for Shanita on pornography is a perfect intersection of racism and sexism, and it's a tool of both, of the patriarchy. And that's what I don't want to lose in this conversation, is the how it functions in the context of both patriarchy and racism, and as a tool. So it's a system by which, white men are privileged, and they are privileged both passively as beneficiaries and also sometimes in aggressive action. So I see pornography as really functioning as a way to dehumanize people. So I don't want to get that aspect of it lost in sort of the sexiness part of pornography. It really works to dehumanize people, and then it makes it impossible to, work the next day with people on an equal basis. So I think it's an interesting time when you think about right now we're doing a lot of talk about the Me Too movement, and the year started out with a lot of talk about rape on campus. And by the time these boys get to campus, and the girls too, their minds have been so muddled with sexist image, and certainly pornography is a part of that and soaked in the culture.
Well, thanks for the call, Bridget. I appreciate it. Shanita Hubbard, are you back with us?
Hello?
Great. Hi.
Yes, I'm here. Hello? Okay. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can. Welcome back. Sorry we lost you there for a second. Talk about the corner dudes, the guys that you write about in this very compelling piece that you published in the Times a week or so ago, and this real tension between needing to be both their defender while at the same time, as a Black woman, you are sometimes their victim. I guess we're still having trouble with Shanita Hubbard, and I apologize for that. But Sherry Parks, Shanita Hubbard writes in this piece about, for example, R. Kelly. Mm-hmm. For years, he's a pop star, a hip-hop artist. For years, there have been reports about his abuse of children.
Yes.
Yet he's still working. He's still out there touring. He's still got people coming to his concerts. You have a Russell Simmons, who is the head of this huge media empire, accused of very serious allegations of rape. I mean, not just, improper massaging, but rape. I mean, just real crimes. Who resigns from his company? I mean, there do seem to be different outcomes for different people.
Well, yeah, and it's that protectiveness of Black men that I was talking about. That African American women are encouraged not to report. I also want to circle back to the link between racism and sexism. Is that in erotic images, Black women are literally dehumanized. They're more often seen as animalistic than women of other races in erotica and porn. So that idea of Black women as sexually available, as not hurting, and therefore a less valuable victim, links into the overprotection. I don't know if it's overprotection, but certainly in this case, inappropriate protection of Black men.
Huffington Post had a piece that suggested there's clear evidence that women of color have to experience a much higher level of sexual misconduct, sexual assault than white women. What does that mean? I mean, given their options after the sexual harassment happens, but they're also victimized at greater levels. Why is that?
And victimized by men of many races.
Mm-hmm.
The feminine ideal is still the white woman, the innocent you know, if you can still use that word, feminine ideal is the white woman. When I was a young black woman, men often assumed I was a prostitute because I was, quote, in the wrong place, and why would I be working in these spots? And I learned that my only defense was to walk into a group of white women because they wouldn't follow me there.
Dr. Sherry Parks is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the University of Maryland College Park. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy, From the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She is a monthly contributor to our program, joining us on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. Thanks, Sherry. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
We'll have more links. We'll have links and more information on our website, WYPR.org/Midday. Coming up on Midday tomorrow, a conversation with Baltimore City Council members Robert Stokes Sr. He represents the 6th District, and Christopher Burnett of the 8th District. We'll see how they assess the priorities of the council as their second year in office begins. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. Appreciate your listening. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.